When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.
Hello, I am Annie McManus. Welcome to Changes. It's so lovely to have you here. You can hear the husk in my voice. It's still lingering post-Glastonbury. It's Tuesday as I record this. Got back from Glastonbury on Sunday. And I just wanted to mention what a pleasant experience I had walking around the festival site for 2 days and meeting so many Changes listeners. I had so many people come up to me and say, oh my God, I really love Changes. I love your podcast. I listen. And it was such a buzz to meet people in person and just to hear that Changes is actually feels like it's kind of traveling far and wide. Thanks so much. I was so chuffed to meet you all at Glastonbury, if you're one of the people who came up to me. And also, if you're just a regular Changes listener, if you're a subscriber, if this is becoming your favourite podcast, thanks. I'm so, so happy to have you with us. And we are working so hard to bring you some brilliant guests, like racking them up for the summer and for the autumn. Yeah, Changes is charging forwards and it feels good. This week on the podcast, I bring you a conversation that is so deeply gripping and inspiring and moving. And it's with a woman called Brenda, who goes by the name Lady Unchained. She's a poet, performer, an award-winning broadcaster, and most relevantly for this podcast, an advocate for life after prison. Brenda is from South London. She spent 11 months inside and 5 months tagged. She went to prison when she was 20 years old, about to launch her own business and with no former convictions, and never ever thought she was the type of person that would ever end up in prison. She is now the founder and creative director of Unchained Poetry, an artistic platform for artists with lived experience of the criminal justice system. And she runs poetry workshops in prisons and in women's centres. She's also just written her first book, Behind Bars, on punishment, prison and release. That's out this week and it's excellent. By changing the ex-offender label through the creative process, she has won numerous prestigious audio awards. So she's just done so, so well for herself after this really, really traumatizing time that she had. Not just the prison time, but what happened within her prison sentences, systemic racism, everything she had to go through and fight through to kind of come back to herself. In this conversation, we go right back to the start before that fatal night when everything changed. But before we get to it, please be aware that there are references to suicide and some experiences you might find upsetting. So check the show notes for all the details. I'm so proud to have Lady Unchained on the podcast and to bring you this story, which I really hope will make you think and look at the world in a different way. That's what Changes is all about. Welcome to Changes, Lady Unchained. I wanted to start with a scene that you talk about in one of your poems where you're walking away from the dock having been convicted of a crime. You talk about having to free her from the journey you were about to take, her being a version of you. Can you tell me who she is or who she was to you at that moment?
I think she was the happy Brenda. I was very proud of my name once upon a time and I was very proud of my smile, and I felt like I had to leave that smile behind because where I was going was filled with darkness and I didn't want to carry a smile that would have made me feel or look weaker to anybody else. So I had to leave that part of me that I guess had faith, had hope, had some kind of motivation to do anything. I had to leave her behind because where I was going, she wouldn't belong there.
What were her dreams and aspirations?
For a long time, I wanted to be an air hostess. I literally done travel and tourism. I was like, I just want to get away, you know. I was on that journey. And then along that way, something changed. Like, a lot of my friends were having children. And I realised that a lot of my friends didn't have childcare. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that I would do a course at the council. Someone told me there's a free course to become a childminder. I was like, free? Nothing is free. Let me do it. And I started to take that journey of becoming a childminder. And she had those dreams of just building a career, building a business, being somebody that people can, you know, look up to, but also someone that will just always make people smile, if that makes sense. Like, I was always the, if you're around me, you're gonna laugh regardless. And yeah, it's taken a long time to get back there. But yeah, that's who she was.
Yeah. Tell me about your family life. Who was around?
So I've got 3 sisters, one older, 2 younger, and I've got an older brother. And obviously my mum, we grew up with my mum, single family household. And we was just that family. Like, we looked after each other. There was like, you know, someone's in trouble, we're all there, we're together. Why did you do that to my sister? That's just how we grew up. And our mum brought us up to make sure, I guess, that we looked after each other. Like, you know, and I remember her always kind of saying, like, you're going to make friends and you're going to meet people, but never forget your family and never make sure you always look out for each other. So that was installed in me from a very young age.
Mm. She sounds strong as your mum, bringing up 5 kids by herself. I mean, that is incredibly admirable.
Honestly, she should probably be the one sitting here talking to you. Her story's amazing.
Let's talk now about the actual big change that changed the course of your life. Can you walk us through what happened step by step, if you don't mind?
So I obviously used to, I guess when I was about 20, I never used to really go out when I was younger. Like, I never went clubbing until I was a lot older.
Right.
And my older sister, she was the kind of going out person. And I remember I was very faithful. So I grew up in a church. I was in a church choir. Mm. At one point, I was writing songs for Sunday school, teaching the Sunday school kids some songs. The faith became something that was something that carried me until about the age of 14.
Right.
And I actually remember promising God that, you know, I would never go to church and then go clubbing. This is at like 13, 14 years old. I don't know why I made this promise to him, but I did.
And that's because you associated clubbing with something that was not like
faithful and spiritual religious.
Yeah.
So I promised him that. And do you know what? As I was getting older, you know, when I got to like 18, 19, I do recall being invited out. And I remember at one point they would say, oh, we're going to go to church, we're going to go evening prayers, and then we're going to go to club. And I'll be like, no. I'll meet you at the club. I can't go to church.
Can't
I promise
both.
God.
Yeah. One or the other.
Him.
Yeah.
And they always used to laugh at me. They used to think like, she's actually just a funny girl. But on this particular night, I don't know what happened. I was asked to go clubbing and church was on the menu too.
Right.
And I don't know why. I said, okay. And it never hit me, this promise, that I forgot it completely. So we went to church, evening prayers. We went out to this nightclub. And back then, I weren't really a drinker. So give me a glass of champagne. I'm like, ooh, the bubbles have got me. I'm already, like, happy. So I remember my sister had a few issues with some girls that right. were, I guess they used to be her friends because I'd seen them once before. And I remember her kind of, like, we're in the club and it was me, her, and a family friend. And I remember her kind of saying, I'm going to go and say hi to, there was a lady that knows my mum. So she went and said hi to her. And I remember she had said that the girls that were after her were in the club. And I just thought, okay, I'm wearing a white dress. Like, I'm just, like, happy. And I recall her walking away. And I saw the girls, but they were, like, so, like, they were on a different side from where she was. And I looked away, carried on, you know, talking to my friend. And I remember looking back. And when I looked back, the girls had drifted. So they had drifted closer to where my sister would have been standing and saying hello to somebody. And everything else after that kind of happened really fast, because it was like I could see her trying to get through the crowd, but they had blocked her. It just looked like they were just pushing each other at first. And then it literally, they just started fighting. And it was like 3 girls. Well, I'll say 3 girls. I would have been 20 and they would have been about in their 30s. I just recall my sister just, I couldn't see her face anymore. And to be honest, my intentions when I went there were more to stop this fight from happening. But what happened when I got to the scene, it was like, I think it was more fight or flight. I was trying to pull people. But to be honest, after that point, Annie, like I can honestly say that I actually blacked out. I do remember like pouring a drink on them. I don't know why in my head I thought, you know, when you're sleeping or you're drunk, people pour water and you like, so wake up, like wake up, stop doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
In my head, I felt like maybe that would have helped, but maybe that made things worse. And then after that, the last thing I remember is just kind of being dragged off of this person. I didn't know what person I was being dragged off of. And people saying the police are coming. And at the time, I couldn't see what I had done to the woman. I could see that I had been cut, and I went to the toilet, got tissue.
Where had you been cut?
On my hand.
Right. From a glass?
With a glass.
Yeah. And was your sister okay?
My sister was okay. She just had some bruising. You know, she obviously was more concerned about me. And I remember, it's weird because at that moment, everybody was saying to me, you have to run because the police is going to come and they're going to lock you up. And I said, well, only guilty people run away. Like, I haven't done anything wrong. My sister was attacked. Like, I can... And people kind of looked at me really weird. But in my eyes, I saw that as self-defense. So I stayed. And people thought I was crazy for this. But I had never been in trouble before. I never, like, been arrested. Like, it wasn't a fear. I didn't know about the criminal justice system. All I knew is that you commit a crime, you do the time kind of thing. And I was very judgmental about people that commit crimes, to be honest. So in my eyes, I didn't feel like I committed a crime. And I did walk out of this club willingly into the arms of the officers and started explaining, you know, this is what happened. And they said, did you hit her? I said, well, it does seem like I did hit her, but, you know, this is my reason. And she said, okay, I understand. What I do recall, and people always think I'm a bit crazy when I say this, and sometimes I even start thinking I'm crazy, but I do recall being told, like, if we had called the police first, then obviously they would have to come for the women. Mm. But because somebody else called the police and I basically looked like I attacked her, they had to arrest me. And I remember her saying, gonna have to hold your arrest for GBH. And I think in that moment, I realized, hold on, like, isn't that like a conviction? Like, is that, you know, and I did panic because everything at that moment felt like it was flashing before me. Everything I was, you know, I just completed the child minding thing. I had my last interview with Ofsted, the Jew. And, you know, when I registered, I had no conviction. So now how do I go back to this organisation and say I'm being charged with something? You know, so I really went into a shutdown mode. I completely started to forget everything I'd done before this moment. I forgot that I had planned this career and I forgot that I had a smile and I was happy. All of that kind of just disappeared quickly.
So GBH stands for grievous bodily harm. And there's a couple of different versions, isn't there? I know, because someone I know got done for ABH. I can't remember what A stands for.
So I got done for GBH Section 18 with intent. The word intent, for me, it's like you intended to cause grievous bodily harm. And there was no intention in my life in that moment that I wanted to cause grievous bodily harm. I wanted to make sure my sister was okay, you know. And a lot of the times I reflect back and I do think, you know, what could I have done differently? And, you know, obviously with my book coming out, I've had to reflect on certain things. And I also have to think, what would I have done if my sister had been stabbed or been killed in that moment? How do I go home to my mother and tell her, I was there, but I just stood there and watched and as your daughter was killed? You know, so for me, it's that being taught, protect your family, look after your own. And that's exactly what I did. And I remember even being more scared that I got arrested to tell my mum. I didn't care about anything else. It's my mum. Like, course, I was like, oh my God, my mum's going to kill me. But I remember when I got out at the police station, my mum was here. And she said to me, you're not going to get this. Is if you defended your sister. Like, even she saw it as like, surely it's fine. None of them were scared for me. None of them felt like it was going to end up with me being convicted and sent to prison. So we had kind of, as a family, we started to lose respect for each other because I was like, they're trying to lock me up. And they were like, you need to have faith. But by this point, the faith was finished. The faith was gone, you know?
Yeah. So before we get on to the next stage, can I just ask about the girl? What happened to her? Did she have any injuries?
Yeah, she had injuries on her face.
Right.
From what I understand. And I don't know about any other injuries, but I know that I caused her injuries to her face.
Your family think you're going to be okay. Have faith. You're having doubts at this point. What was the kind of time frame between then and knowing exactly what your fate was going to be?
The fight happened in June. I was convicted and sentenced in February 2009. I was sent to prison for 2.5 years.
And the time between that, you were on bail?
Yes.
And you talk about bail in your poem, Bail, is saying being on bail feels like a slow death. What did it do to you this time?
It's weird because people kind of feel like you get arrested, you go to jail, everything happens so quickly. But the slow response of never being in a situation of having to go to the police station, having to be fearful of other people, having to think about the fact that you could go to prison, it slowly takes away, you know, that little hope, that little glimmer of hope. I remember going to probation for the first time and I had never had to talk about my life or things that upset me because certain family household, you don't know about mental health, you don't know about depression. How could you have depression as a young person? You've got no bills to pay, you know, so you don't talk about anything. Mm. I remember going to probation and I had this amazing guy called Dan and he just said, tell me about yourself, just tell me about yourself. And honestly, by the end of it, I was in tears. And I remember going, I'm so sorry, I don't really know what's gone on there. And he said, you've never spoken about a lot of things that have happened to you. Mm. And for that reason, I feel like if you were going to commit crimes, Brenda, and he said, I'm not saying it's the right time to do it, but if you was going to, it would have started a long time ago. But you've found ways, I don't know how, you found ways to just be okay. And so I don't want you to get sent to jail. So he actually requested that I get a community service, you know, anger management and some therapy. Obviously that didn't happen. So when you're going through all this stuff, declaring all your pain, kind of going, I'm so sorry, please forgive me. But yet you're being harassed by the so-called people that are the, you know, now the victims, because now you're the criminal and they're the victims, but you're being harassed by them. It becomes a war in yourself, because it got to a point where I thought, you know what? I am the one that's wrong. Everybody else is right. I'm the one that's wrong. Right. I deserve this. I'm a problem. And that was it. I just believed that I didn't deserve anything good anymore.
So when it came to you actually being sentenced to 2.5 years, how did that make you feel? The idea of just finally knowing what was going to happen.
What was going to happen.
Yeah.
The actual sentencing, I can recall just hearing it was muffled words.
Right.
Until the judge actually said 2.5 years. It's it snapped me back into where I was. I can't say the feeling of how that felt, but it was like I've been convicted to death, if that makes sense, because I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know how I was going to act there. I knew that a part of me was already damaged in the process of just waiting for this final hearing. On bail, it feels like you're dying. It feels like you're slowly disappearing from the world. When you're sentenced, it's like, that's it. You're basically in the ground now, because where you're going, there's no love, you know. And I remember being in the cell and, you know, when you cry and it's like the whole of the inside is it's shaking. Tears that I didn't know where they came from. They just kept coming. And part of me kept going, it's a mistake. They're going to come and they're going to tell you this is a mistake. You're not going to prison. No, 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 it's a mistake. Then my solicitor showed up. And in that moment, I thought, she's here to tell me that there's a mistake. And she had a piece of paper, and that piece of paper had all phone numbers, addresses. And I looked at it and I remember thinking, oh my God, I have to have addresses because I have to write letters. You know, I haven't wrote a letter since school, pen pals. You know, now I've got to write letters and get these phone numbers. And I remember her saying, we're going to try and do an appeal for you. Just, you know, I'm going to reach out to you by a letter and stuff. It's going to be okay. And I kind of remember looking at her like, how? They've sentenced me to death. And I know 2.5 years, other people have done longer sentences. Mm. But I'd never been to jail. I didn't know how prison was. I didn't know what to expect. So to me, 2.5 years out of my life at the age of 21 just felt like it was a joke. It felt like I might as well die.
You went to 3 prisons in all, but you started in Holloway. What was your experiences of that?
When we got to Holloway, it was when I realised that for many years, we had walked past this prison, going shopping, going out, going with my cousins. and never acknowledge the fact that that was a prison that housed women. Why would we? Why would we think about it? It's not. It's got nothing to do with us. We don't. Mm. We ain't criminals. We don't know anyone in jail. You know. So it never really hit us. And it's until we got the van turned. That's when I thought, oh my God, we used to. That's the house over there we used to stay in. Things started to kind of fall apart for me because I started to think, how could I be so close to someone who I call family's house and I can't even touch them. I can't even knock on their door. I can't even, you know, walk over there and say, hey. Hello. So going to Holloway, if I'm honest, what I did is that I tried not to cry. And I think it's easier said than done because for me, I felt like tears were weakness. And if you're in jail, you know, this is prison. You know, everyone watched Bad Girls and Cell Block H and all this stuff. Like, you know, I grew up on these shows. So for me, you don't show weakness. So crying was a sign of weakness. And I remember trying really hard to talk to my sister on that one phone call that I got and saying, please call somebody. I can't stay here. Like, I can't, like, and she was like, we're going to try. And I said, no, you need to do it now because I cannot stay here. But I was trying to talk in English and in my language, Luganda, so that people didn't understand how scared I was if I said in English in Holloway. So in each prison, it's like you have an induction wing, which is the journey, the slow kind of drift into the real prison life. And I had a woman that actually heard me speak my language who happened to understand. And she kind of, I guess, mothered me in a way. I think Holloway, for me, the beginning journey was, okay, this is where we are. I'm scared of every single person here. Even the ones, especially the ones that showed me kindness or a little bit of, like, care. Because I thought, if you help me, what do I have to do in return?
Right.
What do I owe you for your favours or your friendliness or your kindness?
Yeah.
So it took me a while. When I looked at the sentence end date and the date where we were at the time, I didn't see how I could last in that position. So I put it in an application and I said, please, can you relook at the date? So I think maybe the judge made a mistake. And honestly, the response came back so quickly, which actually doesn't happen in prison. You're waiting like weeks before that. And I think that's the moment that I realized, okay, so I'm going to die. And this is where I'm going to die. And the decision of taking my own life became a really good idea. It became a very easy option. And I remember people kind of trying to say to me, like, it's going to be okay. But how could you tell me it's going to be okay when you don't know what I'm going through mentally? And I do recall saying goodbye to my sister, my best friend, in a visit, because in my eyes, there was no way I was going to make it through this. There was no way I was going to spend 2.5 years somewhere like this, you know, having been so independent and I had my own flat. I was working towards my goals. So for me, everything that I'd done prior to this sentence was irrelevant. So what was the point of my life?
Yeah.
And what would my life be after this? Because I've never heard of anyone going to jail and coming back and being amazing. I just, that's the end. That's it. Either you die there or you come back even more messed up than before. So I had decided that that would be it and I wouldn't progress after Holloway.
So you were in Holloway for 3 months around that, right?
About 3 months.
And that ended up just being the start of your kind of journey in prison. And this next phase, what happened next?
The next phase of my prison sentence made me miss Holloway. When you're sentenced, you go through immigration, you go through housing, like, cleared. They saw me as British. Fine. All of a sudden, you know, as I'm talking to people in the prison, I'm realising that people keep getting sent to this prison called Moreton Hall. And it's a foreign national prison. And so a lot of people were saying to me, yeah, so you only go there if you don't have passport, if you don't have papers. And then the knock came. You know, when you're getting transferred, they knock the night before, obviously when everyone's locked up so you can't make any phone calls just in case you want to do an escape.
Yeah.
Knocked on the door and they told me, you know, pack your stuff, you're going to Moreton Hall. And I remember saying, miss, I think that there's a mistake here. I can't go to Moreton Hall, it's a foreign national jail and I'm British. And she went, well, you've come up on a list, so you have to go. At this point, I've got friends that's already in this prison writing to me, telling me, certain things are not okay here. They can't tell me in detail, but they said certain things are not okay here. So I remember just crying. I remember, you know, and something that people don't get to hear a lot, like women in prison are very caring for each other. They, you know, yeah, you have the bickering and you have the arguments here and there. But I remember after that knock, everyone through their doors, through their windows was shouting at me, Brenda, it's going to be okay. Don't worry. We've got you. Thingy's there and that one's there and da da da. I packed all my stuff, but I did ask them, if I don't go, what happens? And they said, I'll go to the block. Now, as somebody that's never been to jail, this prison cell that I had, for me, was the block. Like, it was small enough to be a block.
And you were in there on your own, were you?
I was in there on my own. Yeah. So I thought, there's no way this can happen. So I packed off my stuff, went downstairs and got in a van.
And this is 3 months after being in Holloway. So you'd kind of assimilated.
I'd gone to education and I'd done all these things and I was starting to get in the routine. I had a job, made some friends. And now I'm being shipped away. And Holloway's in North London. Moreton Hall is in Lincolnshire. This journey was like dying all over again, but this time no one even knows where you're buried. Like, no one knows. And I remember I couldn't see any black people or Asian people on the streets. I couldn't see that. And I started to get really concerned because I was like, where is this that they're taking me where no one looks like me? And I remember when we finally got to the jail, after how many hours, there was a black man at the gate and I thought, okay,
yeah,
fine, this is fine. After they take you through, you go in, and as soon as all the other women who had left saw me, they came, hugged me. And I remember them, one lady in particular, just kind of hugging me and saying, don't sign anything. And then she just stepped away. Like I'm still like, well, what did you say? But she's acted like she didn't hug me and say that.
Right.
So they gave me my paperwork. Everything's correct in my eyes. My name's correct. My dates are correct. But all my other privileges, they're not there. So HDC, which is TAG, you know, you can home curfew, early release, all of these things are gone. I had them in Holloway. What's happened? Just sign it. If it's wrong, we'll fix it later. And I said, no. But it's wrong now, or there's no later fixing.
Mm. Mm.
And so I remember going, I refused to sign, and automatically, that's it, I'm labelled as like disobedient. Officers treat you like literally slaves, foreigners. You have no rights here. I realised that the only reason I was in that prison is because they believed that I had no paperwork, I was foreign, I was illegal. And I remember going to immigration in this prison, and they cleared me. They said, you're British. So I didn't understand why one officer in particular decided that, because of the fact that I wanted to be transferred back to London where my family, you know, I can see them, he didn't like that and basically threatened me with deportation. And I think in that moment, I didn't know what else to do. I realised that my words weren't helping me because maybe when I spoke, I sound African and fresh or angry and black, that anger, black is anger. I decided the only way I can fight this was to go on hunger strike. And I stopped eating.
Oh my God.
I just stopped eating. There was little comments in the prison that the officers would say, oh, do you get 3 meals a day outside? Really, really? You get 3 meals a day outside, do you?
So they're questioning the fact that you were able to feed yourself outside of jail.
Outside of jail.
They're presuming that you are living a life of poverty.
Literally.
Got you.
So hunger strike was easy.
How long?
They put me on suicide watch until I left.
How long was that?
I think I got to a couple of months. It's weird because eventually I said my mum had to basically come into the prison with my British passport. I had to, and she refused. She said, I'm not giving this to anyone. You can see it in my hand because I don't trust you guys. You're telling me my daughter's illegal. You've made her question if she's even here legally. You've made her question so many things, like you can just look at it. At this point, I'm skinny, but I haven't realised. I haven't seen how much weight I've lost. It's my mum who, honestly, even now, they will tell you in that prison, they all pretended to be okay. They will come and they will smile, but on the journey home, they will just break down. My mum was crying constantly. And she said, they're going to kill my daughter here. They're going to kill her. She's going to die here because I was invisible.
I mean,
was
you
so
must have
skinny.
Been so incredibly weak as well.
I had no energy in that jail. I had absolutely no energy. So even raising my voice was, it was a strain. So it was like, I felt like if I didn't have energy, then I won't argue with them. And if I don't argue with them, they might not see me as the aggressive black woman, African, foreigner that they want to see me as. If I'm like timid and small and quiet, maybe they'll see the vulnerable side of me. Maybe they'll start to understand that I am human, and everything that they're saying and everything that they're doing to me, I feel it. And the only way I can do that, if I was strong and I was eating, I was healthy, I think the fight in me would have just made me get into more trouble. Because I remember him saying, you know, since you're so eager to get transferred, we can deport you back to Uganda. Isn't that where you was born? I just remember thinking, wow, you know, every single part of my body told me this is racism. But every single thing that I've learned was like, this is not allowed. Like, you know, this is not allowed. So after my mum showed the proof, immigration cleared me the second time and the third time, I finally got transferred. And I remember the officer coming to me going, oh yeah, seems like we saw your passport then. And I just remember looking at him like, I hope you're satisfied now. But I didn't speak. I just looked at him with the most, why? Like, what are you getting out of this? Like, what is your personal vendetta with me? Mm. Personally, I don't understand. When I got finally not the knock on the door saying you're getting transferred, can you pack your stuff? You would think I was being transferred home. Because even the officer said, oh my God, I've never seen you smile. And I said, well, there was nothing to smile about until now I'm leaving. You know, so when I was being leaving the jail, I thought I had proven myself as British. So when we got to the reception, they done the same questions. Who you are, name, prison number, what's your nationality? British. I'm going to ask you that question again. What's your nationality? British? I'm going to ask you this question one last time. What is your nationality? And I looked at the officer that come to get me and I went, foreign national. And he went, that wasn't hard, was it? And ticked me off and said, you can take her. So all this stuff that I'd been through to just to get out, you had to get one last kick in. And to finally be on that van again. This time I'm like, oh God, it's going to be another how many hours? No, I'm British now, so I've got rights, okay? So the lady said, you do know we're not going in one, like, you have to stop at another prison. I said, oh, to pick people up? And she went, no, you're staying there the night. And I went, oh, why is that then? She said, well, it's a really long journey. We can't just take you there in one go. And I remember thinking, so what happened to the last time when I was coming here? Is it because I was foreign? Because you thought you were going to deport me? This is, you know, and I didn't say nothing because she has nothing to do with this. Yeah. She's just doing her job, like, this the right way. And I remember thinking, wow, I must be normal again. Like, I'm being transferred to another prison, but you'd think my whole life is being installed again. Like, it's being reinstalled. And sleeping one night in Peterborough, the next day, picked me up, went to HMP Downview, and everything was back to normal. It was like, I had my dates. I was allowed to, if I was, you know, good and behaved, I can get tagged. I can get weekend release. And everything was just amazing. So I remember all the women in Downview going, why are you sucking up to these officers? I said, no. You see, you don't understand where I just come from. Where I come from, the officers don't talk to me like that. These don't sound like they're from South. They banter with me. Like, you know, I remember cracking a joke with one of the officers going, why is this little hole in the door like that? Like, I said, so if a fire starts in my cell, what gonna happen? Can you not let me out? She went, well, that's why the little hole's there, Brenda. We'll just get the hose and hose you down. And I went, but then what if I burn to death? And she went, well, you better not burn yourself to death then. You know, I got that. That's banter. That's like my friends, you know, when all of a sudden I'm back into this place and I know it wasn't home. But for me, it was like I started put the weight on. And it's only when I realized how skinny I was, because I went to get my clothes exchanged.
Yeah.
And none of the clothes fit me. I couldn't even fit a legging. It was like I realized just how skinny I was in that moment. But in that moment before, I didn't see it as that. It was my fight. It was my fight to get out. It was my fight to show that I was actually British, and my fight to prove that I can't be here. That little 13-year-old that used to pray, that used to sing gospel music, she came back. It was really weird because the whole of that sentence, I wasn't praying. I did pray here and there, but I wasn't praying. Mm. So when that faith came back, when the appeal didn't go through, I remember one lady gave me a Mary Mary CD, the album. And I remember playing that and getting down on my knees and crying my eyes out to God and apologizing for everything that I had done, you know, apologizing for who I have become, you know, apologizing for the fact that I went to church, it all hit me. Everything started to come back full circle. And I thought, it's me. I did this to me. I didn't blame these women that attacked my sisters. I didn't blame the judge. I didn't blame the justice system. I blamed myself. I made this mistake. I broke the promise, that one promise that I made. And when I started to reflect on that, everything started to just be more easy. Mm. You know, as humans, we're adaptable. We adapt to our environments anyway, but it became more easy because the faith in me was, it was like it carried me, you know, like, and all this, the writing started happening more. Like, I'd write these little messages to myself, and it was like something happened. I could slowly start to forgive myself. And when I forgave myself, everything started to make sense.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So you were inside for 11 months in total, and yes. Then you were tagged for 5. Yes. There's a line that you wrote that I'd love you to elaborate on, if that's all right. I got tired of waiting for change, so I became the change. I choose to be unchained.
Yes.
Tell me about that, please.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about that line before we even started speaking. I got tired of waiting for change. And I say that because in life, when you're always waiting for someone to save you, you'll be waiting for a long time. We live in a scared society. We're all afraid of everything. We're afraid of everything. We're afraid of the unknown. We're afraid of color. We're afraid of religion. We're afraid. So in order for me to make changes or get help, I had to be the change. I had to become the woman that people told me I could never become because I had been to jail. I had to become the artist that people said that I can never be because I'd been to jail. Mm. I also had to become that part of me that I'd lost, the loving part that had faith, hope, purpose. I had to get that. And in order to get that, I had to become the change that I wanted to see. In my heart of hearts, being on tag, there was a part of me that was so depressed. I remember being in jail going, oh, I don't care. When I get out, I'm going to show my tag. I don't care. Summertime, I'm going to wear my little mini skirt. No, I was embarrassed. So I was wearing boots and everyone's like, are you hot? I'm like, yeah, what? Mind your business. Because I didn't want to show the tag. Mm. You know, I didn't want people to see that. But while I was on tag, I remember watching the news and seeing stats of ex-offenders re-offending, stats, another offender's gone to jail. Stats, ex-offenders don't like change, all this stuff. And I remember sitting there going, who are these ex-offenders that you're talking to? Why are you not talking to me? Why are you not coming to me and listening to why I went to jail and how I want to change or create something for all of us? And I realized that in order for that to happen, in order for people to start to see ex-offenders that actually want to make positive change, I had to become that change. I had to become that person that people can say, actually, hold on a minute. We can't really say that because she ain't gone back. She actually has created a whole platform based on that fact that she don't want to go back. Mm. You know, and it became something that was my purpose. And all of a sudden it was like, actually, you might not think we want to change, but I want to change and I'm going to make the change. And also I'm going to find people that represent that change. And then you can't really say nothing because actually, where are the rest of the people that's doing this? We are the other side to that story. So I'm going to prove that you can create life after prison. And it was hard to do it because for a long time, I didn't believe it myself. But in order to do that, I had to become the visible person that showed people that it's possible.
So what did you have to fight against? Like, what were the prejudices and the obstacles that came before you on leaving prison? Because I presume you think, oh, you're out of prison now. You know, you're fine. You know, you're out of the worst. But it wasn't that way, was it?
No, and a lot, it's actually sad because a lot of people, it's that you get sentenced, you go to jail, you come out, everything's fine. What happens while you're in jail is that you forget that outside, you had this, you had that, you had that. And then you remember it as you're about to come out and realize, actually, I ain't got no flat, I ain't got no job, I ain't got this, I ain't got that. Then you come out. If you didn't have a criminal conviction before, you're coming out with a whole new identity. You're coming out the person you used to be, the person you've been labeled, and that conviction that holds so much weight.
Yeah.
Then you have to go into the community and declare this conviction, because that's installed in you again throughout your sentence. Do not forget to declare your conviction. So I had everything prepared. But what I didn't have prepared is the doors closing in your face. I wasn't prepared for that, because before jail, I created opportunities and I would go for what I want and I would get it.
Yeah.
There was no barrier. But now it's like, actually, I want to open doors for myself, but I can't. I remember going to the job centre and being afraid to tell them that I had conviction. I started volunteering when I got out of jail. So I needed to show people that I can be trusted because I didn't believe that I had that anymore. So volunteering was my way to show people that I can be trusted, but also a way into working with young people and understanding young people with complicated needs. So that was my way in. But unfortunately, even though I was doing so 6 months later, I've got 6 months worth of youth work experience, mentoring. It's not enough. Now there's a little bit more support. But at that time, they didn't know how to work with people with criminal convictions. They didn't have anything. I had more information for them than they can offer me. I got so used to hearing no that for a long time, I thought that no was the only thing. There was never going to be anything for me. After jail, I think, you know, housing, you know, I fought for this flat, but the issues that I've had in this building, you know, to be honest, even just 2 weeks ago, we've had a murder in this block. They can't find out who the killer is because it's a blind spot, you know. And for me, coming out of the prison, you'd think that you'd try to get people back into a different kind of system. You know, like something separate, remove them from areas or environments that kind of carry weight where it's easily accessible for them to reoffend. Having drug users bang on your door, bang on your window, guess what's going to happen? You're going to drink and you're going to take drugs. But if you're put in a situation where that is not around you in an area where you can thrive, then you're going to thrive. There's things that can happen when you get out of jail that if the right support is given to you, you easily be able to return back to society. But because it's so difficult to just get your foot in the door or to be heard, to be seen, unfortunately, it's so easy to be caught in that revolving door and staying in that, well, actually, I'm a criminal, and yeah, everyone thinks I'm a criminal, so whatever, like, they're not going to give me a job.
Tell me what Unchained Poetry is.
Unchained Poetry is a platform to help people with convictions tell their story in a way that they might have never even imagined that they can tell their story, but then also allows people from, you know, backgrounds that don't have criminal convictions to come and hear these stories. It's a way of kind of like show and tell, like, I've got this, this is what's happened, this is my story, but then I don't know that story, so I thought I didn't even know anyone like you. Actually, I met you now, and you're not the person that I see on the media that's like, you know, violent and holding weapons and going and killing people. You're actually just the same as me, and you're actually human, you know. So Unchained Poetry is just that platform that allows us to firstly tell our stories, be free, understand, you know, where we went wrong, how we can change, and how we can help others get into that spotlight. One thing that for me Unchained is and I stole this saying, but I'm gonna use it, Joelle Taylor, don't blame me, please, this is your saying. She said, the mic is not for me, it's for the person behind me. So for me, it's like, this is a chance for you to tell your story and tell it in a way that you want it, whether that's poetry, whether that's rap, whether that's song. You know, we haven't got dancers yet, but hopefully soon get that, tell your story through dance. So it's just an artistic platform to just be creative and also get the confidence. You know, people forget that being on a stage is not easy. It's that confidence boost that you need. You can take that anywhere. And it's so visible when I have like two of my main artists who are male artists that have been to jail. I remember the first event, I said, after you perform, I just want you to stay on stage for a little bit, just 2 minutes. I want to do a little quick Q&A. And I said, Q&A? No. I wrote it in the bars, so they need to listen to the bars. I'm not standing on stage longer than I need to. I was like, okay. Now, one of them is a battle rap artist. Like, he's in Manchester, he's here, he's doing this. based off of these stages that I put them on. Mm. And then the other one is a boxer. He goes into the ring and he's like, all of these things that they're doing are stages.
Yeah. Do you understand? Performative. Yeah.
It's a stage. Boxing is a stage. You know, battle rap is a stage. But before they came to Unchained Nights, they weren't willing to stand on a stage longer than just their bars.
Mm.
I see the growth. I see the process. And I see how, you know, my platform has helped create doors and open doors for other people. But that's because for a long time, as somebody with lived experience, I didn't see how doors were being opened. So again, I had to create the platform in order for others to start.
You created the doors. You created the doors.
Do you know what? I had to, because again, who's going to? Otherwise, I would still be here, you know, listening to radio and going, oh my God, oh, that's an amazing story. Oh my God, oh, that's great, isn't it? But I still ain't in the story. I ain't in the media. I ain't, you know, and the funny thing is, though, I never wanted to be in the media. I just wanted to do enough work that lets people know that they need to give us opportunity. I just wanted to be able to do enough work that we can create change for people that's come from my background.
Yeah.
That's it. All of a sudden, everyone's like, oh, Lady Unchained. I'm like, oh.
You want to get used to the spotlight. You're very good
at it. It's scary. It's scary, but it's great as well. It's great.
Tell me about the change you would still like to make moving forward, please.
The change? Well, so many. I don't even know where to start. But honestly, I think one change that I've created is the fact that people can see ex-offenders in a different light. I do a lot of work within the prison system. Like, I go back in and I lead creative writing workshops. One of my main ones is Unchained Tribe Leaders.
Yeah.
Get them firstly to identify how they can be a leader in their own life, in a leader in their own friendship, in their group, in their family. If I'm honest, 2.5 years I got sentenced. Had it not been for me having faith and being a fighter and believing in myself again slowly, I don't think I'd be doing the work I'm doing now.
Mm.
Prison didn't rehabilitate me. I rehabilitated myself. Yeah. The women in prison helped me rehabilitate. And yes, officers, certain officers there did help me rehabilitate because they were supportive. Now we're putting kids in jail. Yes, people are going to say, well, actually, they killed somebody. They deserve to be there for life. That's fine. Why were they in this situation? How did they get there? When I go to jail, I try to make young people identify how they got there, because we're casting them away. And that's it, forget about them. But no one's trying to ask what happened. How did that young person get into a situation that they felt the need that they have to carry a knife, that they have to sell drugs, that they have to stand on a street corner and be there in order to feed their family? When did it become that children were the ones that were responsible for looking after the household? Who told them this? Something in society has happened where young people are understanding or believing that they are the only people that can help themselves. Just like how I've said, people, no one's going to help you. They've come to that the terms that in such a young age when they shouldn't.
Mm.
We've got a care system that doesn't care for children. I'm meeting little boys from care in prison. How did you get here? Where's your mum? Where's this? You know, for me, I want people to go into jails and talk to these young people. I want the media to read these stories really carefully and go in, interview that young boy, because what happens is we're all hearing a conviction, murder, murder, murder. And it's, yeah, it's terrible. But we're also sentencing these children to death. And I get everyone's going to say, okay, but they shouldn't have done that. But what happened to them? And 15 to 18 year old kids are in prison. Even with my journey, they're still a bit like, oh, what are you going to do then? Oh, what are you going to do then? You're going to be different. No. Oh. You know, and it takes a process. And then all of a sudden they're like, actually, yeah, no, I realise. I can be more than my crime. Maybe I can do this and maybe I can do that. Also understanding that before they came to jail, there was things that were happening that shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
I don't know how we can say a 16-year-old is convicted to 16 years, but no one questions why he had debts of 40 grand at the age of 13.
Yeah.
So for me, the changes I want to see is firstly, less killings. The only way we can do that is to protect the young people from now. The way we can do that also is by actually funding children, because now the cuts and everything that's happened is so massive that there's no youth centers. There's no place to play. I remember being able to play outside in the park when I was young. You ain't playing outside in the park. You're about to fall on a needle. You know, like, this is the world that we're living in. And then we're questioning why these young kids are going out and murdering each other. And it's not a problem to people that are not affected by it. change only happens when you are affected by something and you feel it, you see it, it hurts, and you get so angry that you're like, no, this will not happen again. So for me, I want people to be angry. I want people to get angry enough to say, every child that we walk past is our child. Why are we now in a society where you can't say, hey, I'm going to call your mum. what happened to all that stuff? Like, oh, my mum's going, she's going to call my mum. What happened to all that? We had community, but where we got so afraid, we allowed children to think that they are the adults. And this is the African in me. Children are not the adults. We are the adults. So we now need to act like the adults, treat them like children, and care for them. Mm. That's all they need, care. If one falls, don't we all fall? Or is it just because you're like, well, actually, I'm just going to let go. If that person falls, I'm just going to let go. Then I'll stay standing. That's what we're doing. We're standing on our own and we don't want to stand with anybody else. So let's make the change. Let's actually go and help people and actually try to prevent people from going to jail, because jail's not a good place. People make mistakes. And if you make a mistake, well, don't you want someone to fight for you?
Well, I feel like I need to stand up and give you a standing ovation. Oh my God.
Thank you so much.
Honestly, thank you so much. Thank you for your strength and your resilience and your absolute incredible eloquence in telling that story, your story, which, as you say, is so fucking important for people to hear. It will stay with me always. Honestly, thank you so much.
Thank you so much to Lady Unchained. I said it all at the end there to her. What an inspiration. Her book, Behind Bars, On Punishment, Prison and Release, will be released this Thursday, 7th of July. You can pre-order it now. We will, of course, put a link in the show notes to that, as well as a link to her website, so that you can go and check what she's up to. Do share this episode to everyone you know. I would just love it to travel as far and as wide as possible. Next week, we bring you double BAFTA winner and TV personality and your Grime MC's favourite Grime MC, Big Zoo. Absolutely delighted to have him on Changes. You're going to love that conversation. In the meantime, follow, subscribe, leave a rating where you can. It's so appreciated. Thanks so much for listening. Changes is produced by Louise Mason through DIN Productions. See you next week.